Welcome to the Two Hip Podcast.
Today's guest is a good friend of mine. We worked together on countless projects over the years. We met through a theater group in college while he was studying architecture, physics, and game design. He's got a huge range of interests, but when I think of authentic people who are pursuing what they love, regardless of outside forces, he is one of the first people that pops into my head. Very real. He's got spatial awareness, design sensibilities, great storyteller, in my opinion. And when you combine all those attributes, you get a person who is a great game designer. So he's written and produced a TV series, a web series, won awards at game jams, designed educational games, board games, physical interactive experiences, and competed in the World Championship of Gameful Architecture. Currently a designer and coder on a very cool new gaming platform called Blinks by Move38. I give you Dan King! Applaud! Hey, applaud machine!
Yeah.
Welcome, Dan!
Sound effects.
Hello!
Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I want to maybe give you a minute to explain yourself.
Explain yourself. The hostile segment where you explain you. Like you're on trial.
Yeah, oh, this is actually kind of easy because I've been, like, kind of prepping for job interviews. I'm from Maine, and I went to college originally for architecture, and then was politely asked to leave, and then Danton was there for that, and then transferred to physics and filled the space in between with a very short-lived minor at Syracuse of computer game design. I think I was the last person to get it. I'm pretty sure they shut the program down because right. The only professor who cared left. And then I got out of college and I had a bunch of disparate skills and no like clear pathway to a career. And so I got a job writing for educational games. They just sort of took my word for it that it would work out. I never gave them a writing sample. I didn't have one to give them. And then I did that for 4 years. With some degree of success. And then after I left that job, I kind of just did a lot of stuff. And I'm sort of just coming to the end of like 2 years out from that job. Sorry. I'm like 2 years out from that job, and I'm still kind of figuring out what to do, but I'm now doing more and better versions of it.
Right.
So yeah, I'm designing a lot of things. Some of them are game related, and actually some of them are not.
But I feel like I sort of said it in the intro on purpose, but like I feel like you're the kind of person that you have an interest and you go for it. You have a methodology,
yeah.
I feel like. Like you have a logic to how you go about these choices.
Yeah.
But you're still going after things that you love.
An interest in like designing experiences,
right,
and in storytelling, and I think that the way I like to do that, or that maybe the way I thought I liked to do that and still do, is through game design. But I have dabbled in a lot of other types of design that do the same thing, that you enter this physical or virtual or metaphorical space that I've designed, and you have some experience,
right,
that I'm partially responsible for and partially you're responsible for it.
Yeah. And game design to me seems like the most immersive type of storytelling. Like appreciate it years ago.
It can be.
Yeah, I feel like now as an adult I appreciate it more, especially understanding what goes into making a good game.
Yeah.
There's a lot of thought process. Like you really have to anticipate what the user is actually doing.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're just like writing a story, you don't necessarily need to care as much about how they're going to react to something.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. So one of the things you mentioned was like I worked on this web series called Jaywalk Cop, and worked with Nick Douglas, who was had been doing comedy writing for far longer. I mean, well, I hadn't been doing it at all, so everyone else in the world had been doing it for longer than me, but he had specifically been actually doing it and succeeding at it for many years, and so I learned a lot from doing that project with him because I had a lot of like instincts
right
about how to do something like this, but didn't know which instincts were right and which ones were wrong, and Nick helped me figure out which of my instincts were. And he's very, like, Nick is a great, like, partner, because he's very willing to praise you when you do something right, and he's not willing to praise you when you don't. And so I would come up with a suggestion, and he'd be like, Dan, you have a natural gift. Like, don't hide that in a bushel basket. He wouldn't say that. But then when I would do something that I felt was right, that he knew wasn't, he wouldn't pretend, he wouldn't be quiet about it. He'd be like, Dan, I think you think that's funny. It's not funny. Right. And it's not good storytelling. And he was right. But I don't know.
You need like that kind of directness. Yeah. Which, again, this goes back to the point of this. I know we're going to veer off, but I'm going to occasionally come back to, like, this is about authenticity. And Nick Douglas is a good example of that. He was on Slacktory on YouTube. You can look him up. If you type in Nick Douglas, I'm sure a bunch of videos.
And he's a writer at Lifehacker now.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's done a bunch of different video projects as well online. And at Channel 101 at UCB in New York.
That's fine. Never mind. Yeah. It's only, like, coincidentally. It's not actually associated with UCB. It's just they get the space.
Right.
But, yeah, it's good enough. It's close
enough. But I think he is also one of those people that was, like, very direct to you. And directness, I think there's a fine line. Some people, like, being direct, some people get really offended by.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I've learned to appreciate, like, we've both grown up in industries, like, especially in architecture school and then anything in, like, theater or performing arts, where, like, being blunt, being direct is very helpful as long as you can accept
But also sometimes people miss... I'm not going to be able to summon the word. Sometimes people think they're being direct when they're being mean.
Right.
Because
and that's why it gets misconstrued.
Because it has the same cadence. Being mean and being direct sound similar, but they're not the same thing. And, like, that was maybe one of the things that actually was didn't work for architecture for me is, like, I'm just a little too sensitive. And so I wasn't so great at having people be mean to me.
Right.
And it just wasn't for me. I had a job once as a dishwasher, and I only had it for 2 weeks because kitchens are mean places.
Right.
And I just, like, I knew that they didn't mean it when they yelled at me to, like, get them plates faster.
It's when people are frustrated.
But
it's kind of
I don't want to be part of that. I just don't, like, it's fine. I'm glad people are part of that, but I don't need to be part of that.
So you're aware enough of, like, when you sort of feel... that, like, if you get anger from somebody, you can tell the difference between anger and direction most of the time. Are you, like, that aware of it? Do you understand when it's coming from a real place versus, like, coming from direction?
I was less aware of it in college, and I'm probably still not always aware of it. I definitely also get false positives. I definitely sometimes interpret, this is what you're saying, I definitely sometimes still interpret directness as meanness.
Right.
So I'm not... like, my scale's not totally balanced on that. But I think I have a better sense of it now. I've had some mean events happen to me at jobs that, yeah, I could tell had nothing to do with being direct, had nothing to do with being managed or even coached or mentored. I could just tell that somebody was angry or scared and just wanted me to also feel that way.
Right.
So I've gotten better at it. I certainly am better now than I was in college.
Yeah. Well, like, our good mutual friend, Ian Nicholson,
yes,
with me, he's the one that, like, I always butt heads with, where, like, he's on that border of, I'm not sure if he's being direct and, like, trying to be streamlined, or if he's actually, like, annoyed at something.
Yeah, I've had strange conversations about Ian with people, specifically my therapist recently, Ian can be very, very direct, but I have two things that help me not notice it, which is, one, Ian and I have very, very similar sensibilities, like design sensibilities,
right,
which mean he's rarely in a position to criticize me.
See, I'm usually on the opposite side. That's
have different designs, but, like, Ian and I mean, he's a better designer than me, but if I was as good a designer as him, we would design very similar things.
I see, yeah.
And so... I'm not usually at the end of his directness because he usually doesn't have need to criticize me.
Right, right.
I always find that strange when, like, I've seen Ian B really, like, really bring the hammer down on people, and I've never thought, like, ooh, scary, because it's always like, well, I know he'll never do it to me. Like, because I could just sit here and be like, sure, like, yeah, I've seen him be harsh, but, I mean, he just likes all the stuff that I do.
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems easy.
Well, at that note, I'm just going to take a break before we sort of dive deeper into all these, this conversation that we're getting on. So real quick, new segment!
To hypocrisy, like the reCAPTCHA for authenticity. Meant to be easy on humans, hard on hipster bots.
All right, so this segment is it's called Too Hip is the blog name, right? The podcast. So like, this is the Too Hypocrisy. Like, it's a moment where, you know, I think part of what makes you human is having hypocritical aspects about your personality.
Sure.
Like things that conflict, right? It's sort of like that's part of what being a human is, and I feel like there's these very inauthentic people in the world who have, like, boilerplate answers. Like, everything's very black and white. And I don't think that's reality. So I wanted to highlight real quick, maybe two or three. I'll give you some examples. Two or three, like, I'm calling it, like, the CAPTCHA, reCAPTCHA of humans. You know, like, meant to be easy on humans, hard on bots. That's actually their real tagline for the reCAPTCHA stuff. Yeah. Easy on humans, hard on bots, which I feel like is this, like, that's exactly what I'm looking for. Like, bots being these sort of people that are very like hipster, inauthentic bots, where they're kind of like in their own world, and I want and not being like honest about who they really are. So to me, I wanted let's diverge. I'm gonna give you some examples. So real quick, for example, like I love Reese's cups, but I hate Reese's Pieces. Like it can be really silly. Like I'm just saying, like an example, like that's a contrast. Like I love peanut butter. I'm obsessed with peanut butter, but I have a side. There's a side. There's a conflict. That's a silly one. Another one. Another example.
That's a very legitimate one, because Reese's Pieces are,
I feel like they're trash.
No, they really, they are, because they don't have contrast.
It's not like, yeah, there's no contrast.
There's no contrast.
And the ratio,
the proportions are wrong.
It's like basically like a little shell with that.
Yes.
It doesn't feel right.
Yeah, that's,
it's not natural.
I don't think you should keep that as,
but like,
an example.
But weren't they, like, wasn't that like the first thing? Or was Reese's Cups before Reese's Pieces?
No, Reese's Cups were totally first.
Okay. I don't know my history on Reese's.
Neither do I, but like, I feel very confident that can't be true.
Okay. I believe you. I'm accepting it. I'm just going to move on.
I use this phrase a lot. It has the earmarks of a thing that is true.
Right.
It has all the component pieces of a true thing, so I feel like it's likely to be true.
Okay, so I know this. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Sure.
How about we just, you do one, I'll do one. So I did one.
I had a very strong hypocrisy moment today.
Go ahead.
At work, and I felt very bad about it for like a minute.
Yes. You were at PAX.
Yes, so I'm in Philadelphia because Blinx, the gaming platform, is presenting at PAX Unplugged, I'm here with Jonathan, the inventor, and I walked around the whole convention, and boy, there is a major percentage of the things that are consumed by the board game industry that I actively dislike. Like, couldn't ever imagine spending money on.
Right.
And that I cannot help but judge very strongly just upon seeing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to, like, choose an example without being
super offensive to, like,
mean.
One specific thing. Yeah.
Well, so this is where it kind of shifts into the hypocrisy, which is, like, sometimes I look around and think, I wish I was more successful. Of course, a lot of people, everyone.
Sure, yeah, everybody
probably
feels that. He's
everyone, like, but, like, six people probably feels that way.
People like me with like giant egos and
no, I'm talking about like Jeff Bezos, Carlos Slim, and Bill Gates don't feel that way, and that's like, and Putin,
right?
And that's basically it. Yeah. Everyone else is aspiring to something more. Maybe James Mattis isn't aspiring to anything more, but I can't think of anyone else who isn't. Maybe Obama? No, he's fine. I think I want to be more successful. And then I look around and I think, look at all this dumb shit. Like, these people are making so much money off this stuff that is really stupid. And then, like, what the hell am I talking about? What am I actually talking about? These things aren't stupid. The things I make are stupid to someone else. And if I ever succeeded, someone's going to think that about me. And
at some point, they're going to be like, yeah, this guy doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah, let's say I'm,
There's always a critic of that.
I have this idea that I don't think is a, I think it's an okay idea. I have this idea for like a battleship type mobile game that has asynchronous multiplayer, because I really like asynchronous multiplayer and I think there should be more of it. Mm-hmm. But I like kind of tested it out a little and it's actually not that good. But let's say it was. Let's say I released it and it was the Flappy Bird of 2019.
Right.
Somebody, thousands of people are going to look at it and think like, look at this dipshit making a ton of money off this bad idea.
Right.
And I would be like, oh, don't think that about me. I worked really hard and like, it's appealing to me.
It's just a little bit of a jealousy thing that right. people have.
But I don't want to feel that way towards other people because you know what? The people who make the stuff I don't like, they like the stuff they make.
Right. And that's all that matters.
And that's all that matters.
I think that's, again, that's kind of boiling down to what I'm trying to
get
at.
And they're very lucky that other people like the stuff they make. And yeah. in some ways, maybe I'm just unlucky that right now the stuff I like doesn't have a wide appeal. Or I haven't figured out how to make it have a wide appeal. But, like, who am I to judge someone for using a drawing style that I think is bad or right, using right. a gameplay style that I think is bad, but it is reflexive. It's a reflexive feeling. And I don't want to have that reflexive feeling.
All right. Well, then let's change it up a little bit. So I'll do the second one. My second one for this two hypocrisy, I'm going to call this segment. I love horror movies. But I also like musicals. And I remember seeing a pie chart online like years ago.
Yes.
That said if you liked both of those, you were a serial killer.
Or Sweeney Todd.
Right. And I'm like, I'm neither of those things.
Right.
So I think it's okay to like that. I like musicals and I like horror movies.
But I don't think outside of that meme, anyone's suggesting you can't.
Right.
And also...
And that's reality. That's a different...
I know ton of people that fit inside that. Like, that Venn diagram has got to be way bigger.
Right.
In fact, most of the people that I know that are particularly, like, horror enthusiastic also are kind of, like, into some goofy nonsense.
Well, and I feel like it's more about, like, the story. The writing is fascinating, or the content, or, like, the experience of being scared versus being entertained in a different way.
I can't watch horror movies, but I will read every Wikipedia page on every... Because they always have the twistiest twists.
Right.
But I can't stand to watch them because I won't sleep.
So I like to have those twists, like, in the shows. Like, I'm writing a musical right now. If you're not... If our hundreds of billions of listeners are not aware, I'm working on a musical right now.
You're suggesting that it's going to be broadcast to, like, Residents of the Galaxy.
Right, yeah. Okay. I'm just putting it out there. Cover our bases.
Yeah, that's 97 billion... Well, how many people in the world? 8?
Right, and then all the aliens that are
okay,
listening.
So you're proposing there's 92 billion extraterrestrials.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So what do you have another one off the top of your head? And it doesn't even have to be as elaborate as like the last one, but it can be like something silly. It can be whatever you can think of. I know I'm putting you on the spot here. That's sort of the point.
Well, now it sounds like you're asking if there are contradictions.
Yeah, like sort of silly contradictions.
Oh.
Even if it's just interests or just like things where people wouldn't expect those sort of opposites from you. Like I'll give you my third one,
yeah.
just to give you some time to think. So, I'm a minimalist and a hoarder. It's a big problem.
Okay.
Because like I feel like I have all this crap. But then I also really, really want to be streamlined. And those are at odds all the time. But I think that's, again, that's like an example of authenticity. Real people have things in their life that are like that. There's some internal conflict. Some people can get through it, and they end up being the minimalist where the house is clean, and then some of them are like me where it's kind of in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, so, like, I like to think that I have, like, decent taste in food. Like, I won't eat frozen food. Because I'm just like, I just won't do
it. Want some like real food.
Yeah. But at the same time, I consider like if you eat chips and salsa, that's a snack.
Right.
But if you eat chips and salsa and cheese, that's a meal. But I also won't eat frozen food.
Well, and like, so I'll give you your third one.
Sure.
But just off the top of my head, like from knowing you.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like another one you have is like you're a very good storyteller and like a good, I think a good writer, even though you don't necessarily give yourself much credit for like things like when you did Jaywalk Cop and other things that we've worked on that aren't necessarily published or like really well known. But the but then on the other side of the spectrum, you are like a diehard fan of like the really silly like Jason Statham like action movies.
Right.
And Jason Statham's good. Don't get
me wrong. But I would die on that hill proposing that those are well written.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you're, and
like
some,
I've
some
seen,
of the things
like,
you've
I
done
can
are...
rank the Fast and Furious in how good they are
right
now, but by numbers.
Because you've actually seen them.
Multiple times.
Right. So, like, I think you're on that side of the spectrum of, like, the very poppy, like trendy action movies. Which, like, I feel like right now we're in, like, a high nerd
content. I saw Den of Thieves. I was one of, like, the only people who saw Den of Thieves. But, like, Gerard Butler is playing, like, a corrupt, like, special crimes investigator, and Ice-T's son is trying to rob the mint.
Yeah, this, like, is all, like, foreign to me right now. I am, like, a movie fan, but I don't know, like, what you're talking
about. That was the first movie I saw with MoviePass. I got MoviePass, and I was like, Den of Thieves.
Yes. Dan has like, completely scared, like...
I'm like $100 up on MoviePass. Yeah. I could retain MoviePass for another year and still have profit.
Right. Because you were going, like, every day.
For I also live in New York City. Yeah, yeah. So a movie's $16.
And they're everywhere. There's theaters everywhere. Yeah.
I just had to see one movie a month, and I'm still making them lose money.
Yeah. All right. So I think we're going to, like... That's the end of that segment. All right. So now we'll loosen up a little bit until the very end, where there's, like, a little section at the end where we will take our listener questions. Then get into just some things I want to just get off get off our chest, get going. So, like, the core of this is really about, like, how authenticity and honesty in your life, like, how you as a person, and you might not even be aware of this, but I ask people to come on this podcast because I feel like they have, at their core, they give me the vibe of authenticity, and I like to think I'm good at reading people. And so, like, are you self-aware of this? Like, are you aware of being, like, true in who you are in your pursuits in life?
Yeah, sure. It's, again, like, recently in the job search, I have had some moments of, where I've been too honest in a interview scenario because I imagined, well, I would really like if someone sent me this email.
Right.
Because I'd feel like they were being
real
upfront with me.
Yeah.
And then I would go back and reflect on the email. And I can just tell the story, but I have never been and don't particularly desire to be a very good salesman. And to that end, I was actively interviewing for a job that I was very qualified for. And probably would have demanded a lower salary than a lot of other people they were interviewing. So I felt a shoo-in for this job. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Move 38 kind of offered, like, Jonathan really wanted me to start focusing, because I'd been an intern for Move 38 and I wasn't being paid, and I also was going in once or twice a week for 6 hours, so I wasn't really doing anything worth being paid for. But when the internship ended, Jonathan was like, actually, I'd like you to stick around and actually do this stuff, at least until we release the product.
Right.
And he had offered me that, and he'd offered to pay me, and the internship had ended, so I'd been applying to jobs, so I was also mid-interview with this other job. It's, like, more significant. Also not a real job, but it was gonna be, like, a full-time freelance gig for several months.
Right.
And when Jonathan sort of offered me the chance to work for Move 38, I knew that I would rather do that. I knew that I would rather work for Move 38. And so the other job said to me, all right, Dan, we want you to do a design test. And I'd had an interview with them already where they had said, well, it's, you know, maybe 6 months of freelance, and then if we, depending on what happens, we may consider turning this into a salaried position at the company.
Yeah.
And so
that's
always,
like, a little bit on edge when you're in that situation.
Sure.
Like,
oh, I gotta, but I don't,
is this real?
I'm extraordinarily fortunate that I don't pay rent in New York City. So I can get away... I can soak up a lot of damage.
Yeah.
And so I sent this long email. Here's the thing. Someone sends you an email that says, do a design test. Your response should be yes. My response was, okay, I want to be upfront with you guys. I was offered another position. Would you feel comfortable offering me the design test, than theoretically offering me the job, knowing that at the end of the freelance period, even if you wanted me as an employee, I might say no. In my mind, I was being upfront. I was giving them all the information. Yeah. I wanted them to make an informed decision. They never emailed me back. It just ended there. I spoke to Jonathan about this. Who was the person who was essentially competing with them for my attention.
Right.
And even Jonathan's answer was, Dan, the answer to that email was yes.
Right.
When someone asks you, do a design test, yes. You say no to them when they offer you the job. He's like, I appreciate that you wanted to do this more. But the moment where you lay it all on the table mm-hmm. is when they've made their position clear.
Yeah.
Like,
well, there's like timing with truth now.
Right.
Especially in that situation where like things are kind of, everyone's kind of a little bit veiled. Like behind, yeah. you know, that like you're hiding something, you're not 100% sure.
But I was just so like, I was sitting in my room and I got that email and I was like,
this is the right response.
This is the right thing to say. Yeah. Not even this is the right response. This is the truth.
Yeah.
This is the reality of the situation.
And I think that gets back to my point of like, you don't even process it as being.
I had to have another, when they didn't email me back for a week, and these are some fast moving email people. Right. Like these people were very responsive.
It was like a quick conversation and then just died.
They didn't email me back for a week and I told Jonathan and he was like, oh, you fucked up. Like, you really fucked up.
That's over now.
Yeah. Well, actually, I've done this twice. There was one time that I proposed a freelance project to someone who I'd done several freelance projects before, and it was a VR company, and they said, could you build this physical thing to augment our VR experience?
Right.
And my answer was, yeah, I could build it, but it's not going to fix the fundamental problems with your platform. Guess what? They didn't offer me that project. But, like, in my mind, I don't want them to waste their time building a thing that isn't going to fix the fundamental problem.
Right, it's
the
kind of thing like where if you were already on the team, they'd be like, okay, that's a little bit curt maybe, but like, I get it. Like, Dan or I understand.
I said that in 7 sentences. Yeah. I was polite.
Oh, but I'm sure, I'm not saying it wasn't, but it's still the kind of thing that just comes off as like very abrupt.
Yeah, I've told other people about the situation and they were like, again, Dan, your answer should have been, yes.
Yeah.
The answer is yes. Right. You make the thing, and even though it doesn't solve all their problems, you're not the CEO of that company.
Yeah.
Your job isn't to solve all their problems. Your job is to solve the problem they gave you. But I didn't even consider that as an option. They asked, can you build this augmentation to our platform? And my answer was, you are asking me to do something that is fundamentally not going to fix the problems you have. In fact, it'll waste time and money.
Yeah.
I am not the CEO of that company. I don't need to tell them that. But it never registered to me that wasn't the right answer.
They've probably already invested. I mean, they're doing this search. They've already invested time thinking that hiring a person to do this specific thing is probably going to solve whatever problem they think they have. So even though you have a different perspective on it, like, I guess you got to understand that's where they come from.
No, I Not really. In this situation, they were kind of grasping at straws. They were like, we know there's something wrong with the platform. Could it be this?
Right. But I know you're saying that. Like, it's obvious, but it might not be obvious to them. And that's, like, I think there's a lot more people out there that just don't understand, A, themselves, and, like, how they're really, like, what really needs to happen with other people. Like, I think you get in a position where you're like, I know we want this particular thing, but it's, you think you say it like you know it, but you're really just not sure.
And I think
they're not willing to admit that.
And that's the other unfortunate part is like, if they fix those other problems with their platform, then me building this thing would actually be of great value,
right?
And I would love to do it. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I wish I had just said yes and done it, because then it would be ready for them when they also fix their other problems.
Right.
But I was just so, my immediate response is, Let me answer the question above the question you just asked me.
Yeah.
Because that's what you really want, isn't it? But that's not my job to solve all their problems. My job is to solve the problem they've asked me about. But it just doesn't, that stuff doesn't really occur to me. It's why I'm not a good salesman. Like, I lost a sale. I was a freelancer. Someone offered me money to do a thing, and I made them change their mind.
Right. Yeah, I feel like you gotta be, like, have you ever heard, I listen to Star Talk, if anyone out there is not familiar with the Star Talk podcast with Neil deGrasse Tyson, And there's a really interesting thing he does with that. Like, Cosmic Queries is the end segment where people ask questions from their listener base. And it's usually science related. Every once in a while, he'll get a really like ridiculous question. And instead of even trying to address it, he'll usually be like, he'll just very directly be like, no, or yes, like just very, very succinct. Mm-hmm. And then he'll usually laugh it off and like try to answer it for them. But the point being that like a smart person would just say yes or no right now. Like, I can't answer this question because it's too complicated or it's got too many variables or it's not really a yes or no. So I'm just going to be like, yes, and just end the conversation. And maybe that's what you need to do, is just be like, I'm not lying. I'm just stopping. Right. I'm just saying like, yes or no. I want to continue the conversation and I will, I'll bring out this other stuff at another point.
Like,
you're still being real. You're still being you.
I wish I had taken that design test from that company, and then a month later when they offered me the job, then I had that moment of reconciliation of what I'm actually
going to do. Because for all you
know,
the place you're working for now could have, like, collapsed and you'd be done.
And for all
there.
I know, I could have gotten to that point and they could have been like, well, can we have you 20 hours a week? And I could have done both.
Right.
I never got that opportunity because I decided in the moment that I just wanted to lay all the cards on the table. Because, again, I tried to be empathetic. I put myself in their shoes and I thought, well, I'd like all the information if I was making a hiring decision.
Mm-hmm.
But it works against me.
Yeah. Aside from, like, the job interview stuff, internally, do you have moments where, like, have you ever had a moment where you're working on a project and you're trying to think about it being real, or does it just kind of flow out of your brain? Are there any moments where you're like, I mean, obviously, if you're writing something fictional, a cartoon or a game, you're creating a story, I feel like, based on my experience with you, like, you still want authenticity in the way that things... Like, even in a fictional world, you know, I forget who the writer was. There's this sci-fi writer, I believe, that always kind of used to say that you could build the world... Like, get your science and facts right, and then distort it at your leisure. Like, do you feel like you're doing that? Like, you want reality behind it. I mean, I almost feel like you're on the opposite end. Like, you create the story, you come up with the stuff, and then you build, like, rigidity into it.
No, I mean, I'm definitely a... there's a quote that I feel like is usually... So, you know, you've heard the phrase, reality is stranger than fiction.
Right, yeah.
Do you know the next half of the sentence?
Not at all.
Right. The next half of the sentence, it doesn't contradict it, it just makes that quote make a lot more sense.
Okay.
It is, reality is stranger than fiction because fiction has to make sense.
Mm.
And it is, the quote is 10 times better that
way. Right.
It's amazing. It's an amazing quote. Reality is stranger than fiction is a meaningless couple of words because fiction has to make sense. I think about that all the time, especially when I'm writing fiction.
Okay.
It still has
to make sense.
It still has to make sense. Reality doesn't have to make sense because it's not accountable to anyone.
Interesting.
But fiction is accountable to the person who creates it. The person who creates it is accountable for what's in their work.
Right.
But nobody's accountable for reality.
Right, okay.
Right.
So there's ultimately, like, there's a person there's a person or persons that's accountable for whatever this
physics doesn't make mistakes.
Yeah.
We just made a mistake in our description of it.
Right.
But writers make mistakes. they can make them.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't really think about.
Yeah, so I think about that all the time when I'm writing. I'm a huge, huge stickler for... You make your rules and you follow them.
Of course,
so I have no problem if your rule is people can do magic. I have a huge problem if your rule is people do magic using wands, but then some people don't. Or if your rule is you do... I'm talking about Harry Potter. Or if your rule is magic words matter, except when they don't.
It's like that. Then you're breaking all your own rules.
Yeah, it's like, well, then why make the rule? Just say magic is... extra century, like, do Lord of the Rings magic. You ever notice, like, Gandalf doesn't ever really do anything specific. He just has an aura of power.
Yeah,
he's
a little
powerful.
Different than everybody else.
He's different than everyone else. He can summon light.
Yeah,
but
he can summon birds. I mean,
no, but is that magic or is that just like that?
that's
friendly with
the
birds.
He's just friendly with the birds,
right? But that's the kind of thing is like, there's Gandalf never says any magic words. His staff is important in the sense that I think he likes it, but if he dropped it, I think he'd be okay. Whereas, like, the Harry Potter universe, I had a hard time getting into because it has these inconsistencies that...
You're going to piss off all the Harry Potter fans that are listening.
The bajillions. Good. They should think about it.
I want to know, because I'm a huge fan.
Look, I shouldn't have said the wand thing, because the wand thing is well explained and well taken care of in the lore that wands are conduits. Just like water can sort of like flow off a waterfall or flow through a pipe, and when it's through a pipe, it's more directed. I get the wand thing is great. I shouldn't have even said it.
Fine. Curse you, Dad.
The magic words thing is an inexcusable mess.
Okay, explain.
Because, and just to make sure, like, I just want to point out that I'm bringing this up because I'm a huge believer that things that are authentic or believable have to follow internal rules.
Right.
They don't have to follow the rules of reality. There's no magic in reality. Yeah. But something that's always bothered me is that magic in Harry Potter is communicated in a couple of ways. There's a sense that at a higher level, it's just a sort of, it's gestural. One of the Weasleys, like, does the dishes by just sort of, like, waving her hand at them.
Right.
And it just sort of does things that, I don't know that there would be a written, like, Pig Latin spell that washes the dishes. I think she just sort of exerts a magical force on the universe. Basically, that magic is an extension of your will. It's spooky action at a distance, which is one of the best physics phrases in the world.
Yes, I've heard spooky action.
But, and that's fine. I would totally be down with that. And I would totally be down with the inclusion of wands in that. And I would totally be down for Hogwarts to be a place where they teach you to focus on an idea and make it happen. And they give you some examples. Here's an easy thing. Make a thing float.
Right.
Right? The problem is that they spend a great deal of time dealing with magic words as a concept. You say
courses where they're learning very specific
to such an extreme degree that the pronunciation of vowels can affect whether or not magic happens.
Right.
It is
that, like,
one of the most
the whole
famous scenes in Harry Potter.
In the beginning
is
of
Leviosa.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Where Hermione gets it right.
Right.
And it's very.
Which is to
and
imply
Ron just, like, is slightly off.
Right. Which is to imply that vowel sounds can affect
the quality of the
quality of magic.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, so I understand that's the logic you're coming from, because that was a lot of the beginning, like the first book or movie, depending on.
In addition, and I don't know this for a fact because I only read 4 of the books, but my understanding from my, like, kind of research and kind of talking to other people is that there has been at least one time in the run of Harry Potter in canon where they said a magic word not knowing what the spell was supposed to do. There's a time when they read a curse.
Like out of a book or something.
Out of a book.
Yeah.
And they don't know what it does.
Right.
And when they say it, it splorps out of their wand and it does a thing they don't expect. So that is to imply that that magic is an external, it's not from inside the human body. It's an external force that has gatekeepers. It has a supernatural, I like to think of it as, it has a bookkeeper god. Who is checking your work.
Right.
Did you say Leviosa? Or did you say Leviosa?
Yeah, that's
because
an interesting
I am
point.
Not going to dole out magic unless you said Leviosa. Right? And again, if that's how magic works in your world, fucking great.
But then there's moments where someone just kind of does a flick and it's
you
very
can
internal.
Just, right. You can just kind of do stuff.
Yeah.
Which means, are you saying the word in your head? Is the bookkeeper god... Once you've graduated from bookkeeper god magic school, does he just put a piece of the magic inside of you?
Right.
And now you can summon it at will? And now you can do things that aren't spell specific. Like in like
Man,
the new
I'm like a diehard fan, by the way, and this is actually making me question what the logic really is. Yeah,
there
I haven't really asked that question.
Isn't, because the first book is a children's book and the seventh book is not. The same way that Tom Bombadil basically doesn't make sense in Lord of the Rings because he is a children's character and Gandalf is not.
Yeah, which is the writer evolved as well in the process.
And so J.K. Rowling evolved as she wrote the books and became... I don't want to give her credit for becoming a better world builder because of what's happening right now in the Harry Potter universe.
The Grindelwald stuff is kind
so
of not that
let's
great,
just
yeah.
say that she changed. But the rules of Harry Potter are not consistent. Is magic internal? If it is, then vowel sounds shouldn't matter. is magic external? Okay, then you shouldn't be able to just do stuff by thinking it. It's one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and when I read the books, I never thought about the sort of gatekeeper aspect, because in my mind I was like, the way it's portrayed in the book is, oh, it's very internal.
Yes.
But
then
you're right.
Pronunciation
shouldn't
matter.
But by the books, like, why did pronunciation matter?
What if a student...
If it's like, it should be like, you should feel the spell in order for it to...
What if a student comes to Hogwarts with an accent? They just can't do shit?
Right, yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah.
Like, what about all the, there's literally other schools that have different accents. Are there spells in different languages?
How do Russians say Leviosa?
Right.
How do the Durmstrang students say Leviosa? Does it work at Durmstrang?
Yeah, is it the same spell? Because you would imagine it'd be pronounced.
Or do they have their own Russian spell?
Yeah, oh man, this is like, this is like opening things up for me.
Yeah, it's bad rulemaking.
Okay.
And so, I still
like the world, but I can appreciate what you're
saying. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
In the sense of, like, that... And again, actually, this is a good example. I don't feel as if my feelings about rule following should matter to anyone but me.
Right. But that's how you operate.
Right.
And so
just the same way that I could sit next to someone and watch The Transporter, and they could say, this fucking over the top. And I can go, yeah, fucking is. And I love it. Like, I don't think their disgust with over the top punching should affect my enjoyment of over the top punching.
Right.
Just the same way that the fact that there is or isn't a bookkeeper god in the magic universe,
and I
can't deal with Harry Potter because of it, should affect anyone else's feelings about Harry Potter.
Yeah, like one of my favorite movies, and I will completely admit this, it's not like I'm hiding it from anybody.
Are you going to say Under the Tuscan Sun?
No.
Okay, keep going.
It's not a bad movie, don't get me
that
wrong.
That was the first thing I noticed when I went to your house in college, that you owned Under the Tuscan Sun.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe my mom gave it to me or something. It's a decent movie. But
sure.
one of my favorites, like going way back, is Last Action Hero. Oh, you're missing out, man.
I know.
It's a very, very self-aware Schwarzenegger playing an action hero.
It's early Shane Black, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Shane Black worked on the script and some things changed. And so I really don't know like what the real script is. I think Shane Black has said he's really annoyed with the final product. And other writers that worked on it were annoyed that like things changed, which I think happens all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm not really on that level. But the point is that like it's this like sort of very silly... movie where this kid ends up in this world within the movie that he loves, which is sort of like a Schwarzenegger action movie, and he ends up in the universe as one of the characters, and they have their own logic, and sometimes it does get broken. It's a little bit messy when I go back and like try to look at it under scrutiny, but it's still one of my favorite movies. And when I told some people like that in college, like our friend Alex Coulomb, he was like, I think he was horrified that I like this movie based on just like seeing the trailer. He's like, this is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And then like him and Morgan and sat down and watched it with me and we all lived together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, they were completely into it, like completely on board. And Alex now references that movie, like for years has referenced that movie as like a really good movie because it's like the concept is so fascinating. And for me, like concept supersedes the rules. Like I know you have your logic, but for me, like if the overall concept is really fascinating and they mess up on a couple things, I like the experiment. Like, it still seems worth it to me.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate that there's some bumpiness. But to me, it's funny because we're talking about, like, authenticity and, like, being real. But, like, to me, being real is like, stumbling through, like you're like, workshopping some stuff. You're, like, you know, you might not think of a finished movie as being workshopped, but there's still, like, everything is really unfinished.
Yeah.
There's just some point where somebody had to stop and say, this is the movie. But,
yeah,
like, it's still always been... like work in progress, and I feel like
I think what I find difficult is that I have a hard time coming up with a story or coming up with a product where all the rule stuff doesn't sort itself out. Like I find that inconsistency to be damaging.
Yeah, well,
and
I think
so
if
I don't
you
create
combine
things
that...
with that inconsistency because I wouldn't enjoy them. I don't really create things that I wouldn't enjoy.
Right.
I think as most people who make things.
I think if you took like that level of like that idea, like the type of person who can come up with that really good idea, and then you combine them with someone who can get to that level of like let's polish it so the world makes sense and so everything has its own internal logic, that's a good like duo almost. But I feel like sometimes it's like a different type of person.
I also think like again to like I said earlier, like I'll die on this hill, but in my mind, someone could say, well, the transporter, like, the rules of reality are all fucked up in that. or Fast and the Furious. Like, the rules of reality are a mess in that.
But I love the Diesel jump across the highway.
Yeah, great. Do it. He takes a pipe and he hits the ground so hard that he cracks pavement.
Yeah.
But
you don't know, you can't do that?
Well,
I mean, I do it all the time.
Not recently.
Oh, okay.
But what I like, to me, that is not inconsistent, because the Fast and Furious movies take place in a world.
It says battery low. Is it still recording? That's the question. Dan and I had a little glitch there. One of my recording devices kind of crapped out on me, basically, and I'm switching to a different one. So you might notice a little subtle difference between the two. I'll try to clean it up. So you don't, and it looks seamless and beautiful. But I'm sure you might pick up on something. Anyway, let's pick up where we were. What were we talking about?
I was saying that I think that things that have fiction that has consistent internal rules is inherently better, or at least inherently, it's more enjoyable to me and therefore easier for me to create. And I was saying that my love for dumb action movies, I feel, is like totally within reason, because in those movies it's clear that the laws of like human durability are just different. Things are just different. Like, essentially, if you could consider a frail, weak child as a zero on the human power scale, and like Muhammad Ali at the like top of his like shape,
right,
at 100, right, in those dumb movies there are some humans who can achieve 200.
Right.
And it's just an accepted fact that some people are just born able to leap buildings relatively and fight and run for extraordinary amounts of time and be punched in the face 1,000 times and maintain focus.
And you're willing to accept that.
And I'm willing to accept that because those movies, everyone's like that.
Yeah.
Like, there's just all of the people involved in the good guy and bad guy stuff are just, they're
better humans.
They're just better humans. They're just... We have a 0 through 100, and those movies take place in a world where there's 0 through 200.
Right.
There is a class of human that can just take extraordinary amounts of physical damage and exert themselves for extraordinary amounts of time.
Okay.
But the movie, everyone's like that. It just works. And that's fine with me. It doesn't have to follow.
I think it's okay to be
rules.
Fine with you.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that you're so hardcore about like most other logic.
Yeah.
But it's
internally consistent.
If you say so.
It's just not consistent with reality, but it doesn't have to be. It just has to be consistent with itself.
Yeah, I guess it isn't. It doesn't have to be consistent with reality.
Yeah.
I guess I can.
Harry Potter's not consistent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, so let's just dive into some stuff here for a minute. We've actually been talking for like a good chunk of time. So I want to use this moment to kind of go into what I'm calling like the deep dive here. And basically this is the minute or a couple minutes. You don't have to spend too much time on each question, but just these are our random listener questions. They're not geared towards a guest because they didn't know who the guest was going to be when the questions are sent out. And I get questions and then I put them together sort of randomly depending on the guest. So it's more, they're more, maybe more vague. They're not specific to like your path because like I said, the person doesn't know who you are in advance. So where are one of them here? Okay. So let's go through, one of the questions real quick. It can be a pretty basic answer. You try to get as deep as you can, but also like in a short time. So, what is your earliest memory of a moment when you first expressed your individuality and sort of began to consciously understand who you are as a person, like understand like you?
Yeah. It's not my earliest memory.
Okay.
But my earliest memory of a thing where I felt like differentiation from other people.
Sure. Like you sort of started to understand
an identity.
That's how I'm interpreting it. But yeah.
So
understood your individuality.
I have a memory of going to the first day of kindergarten. And there was these toys that were these small plastic bears. I don't really know what the point of the little bears. It's like a counting toy, maybe. It's like teaching kids to count or colors.
Okay.
And I grabbed a little blue bear. And I said, oh, this is awesome. Blue is my favorite color. And immediately, like four or five other kids also were like, yeah, mine too. And also, we had a bucket of bears. Grabbed a bunch of blue ones.
Right.
And I remember thinking, like, I wonder if I should be concerned about this. Like, is it okay that all of us have the same favorite? Like, what does that mean? Like,
right.
Should I just choose another favorite color?
Like, interesting. Okay.
Maybe I should just choose another favorite color. And I did. In that moment, I changed my favorite color to yellow because I remember thinking, I've never heard anyone say yellow's their favorite color.
So you were like intentionally trying
to differentiate. But I don't like yellow that much. It wasn't until many years later that I actually kind of like settled on an actual favorite color that I think is a good color.
Yeah.
For a while, I
like
just
sort of... cobalt blue. Like, oh, it's a little more specific.
No, I just like orange. I kind of vacillated. I went yellow, gray, purple. I just was like trying to choose stuff that I felt was different before mm-hmm. I realized that's not the point of it. But I remember thinking in kindergarten, that's too many people with the same favorite color. This presents a problem.
Right.
I don't know what the problem
That's
is.
That's interesting.
But yeah, it feels problematic.
I actually wasn't expecting a memory that early. Like I thought maybe you'd think of something old. Like I can't even think of something that I'm trying right now to rack my brain on this one. And that's an interesting question. Like I don't know when did I first experience
it. You walk in the door and there's the desks, and then to the left is this little walled off space that's the toy area, and then beyond that is the story circle. Right. I was sort of in the sort of threshold between the toy area and the desk area.
Yeah.
I have very distinct memory. Mrs. Baker, Barker. Barker's? Baker? You know what? I'll never know. My parents always called her High Pants because apparently she wore her pants really high. I don't remember her real name.
I would have to think, like, it's almost something much later. I think I did a talent show in, like, fourth grade. And I was like, I'm going to be really different. Like, everybody did, like, would sing like a pop song at the time and I was like, that's too easy, like I'm gonna do
Hero by Enrique Iglesias.
But I was like, I don't want to hear another one of this, like a fourth grader trying to sing this like really intense song or just something silly. And I was like, I'm gonna be individual, I'm gonna do a mime act.
Yeah.
Which is very popular among fourth graders. I don't know if you know that.
Very accessible.
So I did like a mime act, and I managed to convince my friend Pierre to do it, and
racist, but go on.
In retrospect, this is really horrible. Pierre was black. Okay. He's black. Yeah. He hasn't changed his ethnicity. This is going to sound horrible. I really was not aware of this at the time of how bad this was, and no one stopped me. Yeah. But and he didn't stop me. Because I was a mime, I actually had a white face on my white skin, but like you still paint it white.
Yeah,
and then. He had white face, which is that racist?
No.
Because it's not blackface, but he had like the white face, and like now I'm like,
but it wasn't white face. He had mime face.
He had mime face. You're right. It wasn't white face. It was like very like silly.
White face is like white like me from SNL. That's or Dave Chappelle. That's white face.
Yes.
You had mime face.
Yeah.
So that's not problematic.
But Pierre was joined me on this sort of like.
Oh, I said it was racist because I assumed he was French.
No, he's not French.
Okay.
Well, I mean, maybe somewhere along the line.
Sure.
He's
yeah.
But his parents like the name Pierre. Very cool kid. But nonetheless, we did this like mime thing, which I thought was cutting edge at the time.
Did it kill?
No.
Oh, okay.
The audience was as silent as our act. That was pretty much how it went.
They were supporting you.
And at the end, I could hear the teachers be like, and I was like, maybe this isn't my career choice. And then I went on to juggling instead, which was equally successful.
I just kind of wished I learned that.
I learned the skill, which was good, but I'm not like a professional juggler, obviously. Anyway, okay, so that's sort of one question. We'll just do one more. We'll jump into here. Okay, so do you feel like you've ever been frustrated by people who lack self-awareness? And this don't just say yes or no, but like elaborate.
I almost don't want to elaborate. Of course, yes.
Like, is there an example of where you feel like you don't have to be specific, but just something where you feel like you've been frustrated by someone lacking self-awareness? Like, do you feel like it's a societal thing? Like, there's a lot of people who lack self-awareness.
I don't know.
Do you want people to all be at the same level of self-awareness?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like it's an important thing, right?
I think that'd be productive. I don't know that I can answer this question because... I don't know that I can think of any real examples that are not... Is that doing it?
We're good.
Oh. I don't know if I can think of any examples that are not very specific. I don't really want to say them, but...
Like, there's... I feel like the most frustrated and angry people in the world, without being specific, tend to be the ones that are the least self-aware. Like
when you have... least self-aware about certain aspects of themselves.
Of their personality. Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's some sort of interesting anecdote about this that doesn't just seem like I'm just talking about some shit about somebody. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't think I have, like, a great example for that. I will tell you that there was an eHarmony commercial when I was a kid. And this is not relevant. There's an eHarmony commercial where they were like... It was like an early dating site that asked questions. That was like their...
That was their thing. They were the first one to do that.
We ask questions, right. And then we use some sort of, I'm sure, very rudimentary algorithm to match up with people.
Yeah, definitely.
The commercials were about that. And there would be testimonials, people going, I've never been asked these. They're asking me questions. This is amazing.
Right.
And one of the commercials, I wish I could find it, somebody, I don't remember, man or woman, says, you know, one of the questions was, are you self-aware? And I realized I've never been asked that. And that was like an anecdote that was supposed to excite me. But I must have been 12.
Right.
And that made me immediately upset. Because the only answer to that question is yes. Because even if, before being asked, the answer would have been no. The answer
It becomes yes.
By answering a question about yourself, you become self-aware.
Yeah, that's actually a good point.
There shouldn't be a no button.
Right.
If you click the no button, they should kick you off the site.
You don't know how to answer questions.
You're an idiot. Like,
that's a good point.
And that, as a kid, I was just like, I felt like I had solved a Rubik's Cube. I was like, Dad, Dad, they've made a mistake.
I like that. Yeah, well, and another thing that I remember that's sort of similar was, like, me and my roommates in college, we'd have these like really deep, trippy conversations, like where we would just get into the universe. And for some of the friends in the room, there might have been some drug use, but I'm not saying that's necessary. The point is that like we were all still having conversations about like our place in the universe and like really big picture questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at one point, one of our friends who like lived in the dorm, who I'm still friends with, she's a nice person. But I remember asking her, like, about something we were talking about. And she's like, no, I can't do those questions. It, like, stresses me out. Like, I can't think about that. And, like, she just, like, doesn't like talking about, like, big picture, like, where you fit in the world.
I had a similar experience in college.
Yeah, I was like...
With someone in studio.
How do you not want to understand that? And, like, it just seems like you don't want to exist in the world.
Yeah,
it's like very off-putting to me, I've like it's like lingered with me. Obviously, I still remember it now.
Yeah, I remember someone in studio, freshman studio, like I asked him a similar kind of question, like, "What are your thoughts about like the nature of reality?" And their answer was, "I don't have thoughts about that. Why would I?"
Yeah,
and it was like, "Well, you live in it."
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. It's like you don't need to be a psychology major
you
to like, want to understand
major.
This. You don't need to be like an astrophysicist.
You don't need
like,
to be
want to know about
older
space
than seven, like. You're telling me you've been alive for 19 years and you've never thought about the nature of reality?
Yeah, like, or just even in like just in a very more like subtle way, like just why you're here or like like the world that you're living in. Yeah, that question a little bit. I'm fascinated by it. All the like the science podcasts I'm listening to right now and I'm obsessing over because they do that. They're constantly like questioning from every avenue of thought, like where we are. And like why we're here to some degree. I mean,
funny. I the question why we're here, I always think is actually largely irrelevant to science. It's how are we here?
How are we here? That's a good point.
It's how precisely can we describe the nature in which we are here?
Of course, you would try to take my answer and make it more precise. Completely ties into what we're talking about.
I do have I did just barely get a degree in physics, just enough to sound.
Like
a scientist, but not with none of the skills that would make me a scientist.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Well, let's end it there. So the last couple things. Well, first, like, do you want to just quickly talk about the project you're working on right now, and like if people are interested or anything that you have coming up? You don't have to. And then after that, we'll talk about the charity, which is the aspect of this podcast at the end,
yes.
Where the guest has a charity they want to mention, and we'll give some information on the website about that.
Sure. I forget the first part.
do you have something like a personal project or your like the
thing you're working on? I mean, Blinks.
You can
from
Google
Move 38.
Yeah,
can,
Move 38.
Yeah, Move38.com. You can find Blinks on maybe Facebook. I haven't had Facebook.
Is it still
in a long
on Kickstarter?
Time. No. So it was Kickstarted successfully a year ago. It's being fulfilled early next year. There'll be a limited number of non-Kickstarter sets.
Yeah. Can you like give like a 1-minute summary of what the actual thing, what it does?
Sure. It's a hybrid digital analog tabletop gaming system. So what it looks like, I'll describe it, although you should just look it up because it's hard to describe. There's small plastic hexagons with lights on top that you can click. They have a sort of an internal hidden
touch
button.
Responsive,
it's touch responsive, but they can also talk to each other and they magnetically stick together. So you put two of the hexagons together, they know they're next to each other, they can pass messages like they're kids in school. And with this technology, we can program some decently complex abstract and some not that abstract games.
Right.
And
well, so I think the first one that's really obvious is you have like a whack-a-mole type game.
Yeah, that's super, super simple.
Yeah.
It's just,
and so you can understand very quickly. It's almost like whack-a-mole. What was the, there was that game, it was like an actual game, a handheld game system you used to play where like you would, red light goes off, you hit the red light.
Yeah.
Red and yellow goes, you
Simon.
Hit red and yellow.
Yeah,
Simon.
Yeah.
So it's sort of, it can do things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so it can do very simple things like one of these is going to turn red, one of these is going to turn blue. It can also do
and
very
you have
complex
to press that
things.
Hexagon.
Yeah. So it just, it's an open source platform. If I've been saying this to people all day. If you wanted to steal all the code I've written over the next 3 months, you could do it right now. it's all available. It's all open source.
And then you can like plug in games if you're the kind of person that can come up with games.
Yeah, if you want to come up with stuff, it's all coded in Arduino, a language I did not know a couple months ago, and now I'm fine at. but it's really cool. It's a thing that I think like has a space. I think there's space for it in the tabletop gaming space because it is remarkably unique.
I agree.
And pretty like pretty clear. That's the thing. It's hard to describe, but once you're touching one, it's very easy to understand.
It's very like a tangible thing.
Yeah.
I got to play with them. Dan brought them by. And
it's very obvious once you've got it in your hands. It's hard for me to explain it to people.
But yeah, the video I think does help a lot.
Yeah.
If you go online and try to look this up. And it's just, it's very fun and like it very quick to understand, I think.
But that's the thing is, this is the other thing we have to pretend. It's a platform. So right now we're programming games. There are 12 games going out.
Right.
But it's a platform. So we're going to make more games. Developers are going to make more games. Maybe we get licensing deals and somebody else will make games
from
there.
Yeah. Well, I hope good things happen with that.
Donation directions. Directions on where and how to donate your donations.
Is there a specific thing you've thought about?
I think the Juvenile Diabetes Research Fund. Is that what the F stands for? It's got it.
Juvenile Diabetes Foundation?
Yeah,
Foundation?
It's definitely JDRF.
JDRF, okay. We'll set up the link on the website. We'll make sure it's the right one.
It's just a good... It's a disease that, they're working on it. And I don't know anything. I don't know anything about the science of it, but it feels curable.
Yes. Seems like it's close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly well-understood condition.
Right.
And they're making huge strides. Even over the course of my lifetime, my mom has diabetes. The way that she tests her blood sugar has changed drastically. The way that she takes insulin, the way the insulin is made.
Right.
Things are changing really, really quickly. And it, to me, sometimes it feels like we're like just half a generation from nobody having diabetes.
Right. I actually, I just did JDRF, I'm saying it right?
I think so.
JDRF walk run, like in Philly, there was
I've done
one.
Those, yeah.
And I did it with a group. My
Susan
niece,
Collins,
Mia, has juvenile diabetes also. And it's very important. I think that's a good, I appreciate you putting that. We'll make sure we put it on the website. And the other little anecdote, it like sort of related to the research, I think it was actually where we went to school, which was Syracuse.
Yeah.
There was a few years back, it probably isn't at the point now where it's like out in public, I'm sure, but there was the beginning research of how to attach insulin to something that your body can absorb in the right way. Because right now, the thing is trying to get it into your blood system directly.
You have to inject it. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why you have to inject it. But they found out that there's a way, by attaching it to like iron supplements.
They can bind it to something.
By binding it to iron, that actually goes into your blood system when you take like an iron supplement. I don't remember the exact details because I'm not a science person necessarily.
But again, like it feels like, man, people understand this stuff really well.
Right. And so then people could just be taking pills and it would be so much simpler.
Yeah.
And I think maybe, especially for juvenile diabetes, there's like a little bit of a stigma with like kids who have to like do injections, like step out of
that. Yeah, they got to leave the classroom. It's like a little uncomfortable. And the pumps, like now they have pumps that like automate it, but right. Now a kid's wearing what looks like a beeper and it's, there's a patch on their skin with a needle in it. Like that, yeah. I think that'd probably freak a kid out.
If you were just taking pills,
pills and, you know, lunchtime, and that's maybe a little less weird.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. I think that's a good organization. So I just want to say thank you again. It's been awesome. Mm-hmm. I think we dove into some good stuff there, aside from the little technical glitch in the middle, if you could tell. We'll see how my editing goes.
That's fine.
And I appreciate you coming, Dan. Thank you for being a guest on Too Hip.